pure as possible and slap two pieces together as quickly as possible. That much we knew. There were only three things we didn't know. One, how much do you have to bring together, a pound or 100 pounds? We call that the critical mass. Two, how to design a container and a trigger mechanism to bring the two hunks of uranium together over the target. And three, how do you hold the two hunks together long enough to get a real explosion and not just a dud?
Oh, now, wait a minute. Hold everything, Bill. What does he mean, hold the bomb together? I thought we wanted to blow it up.
That's right, Bob. But the big problem was this. You slap the two pieces of uranium together, like that. They split an atom, and that starts that chain reaction we've been talking about.
That's right, and we have an atomic bomb.
Correct. But if you want something to take your breath away, just listen to this.
We call our job at Los Alamos extending the generations. The two pieces of uranium come together, there's a chain reaction, they fly apart, and there's an explosion which takes 1/1,000,000th of a second. Get that, 1/1,000,000th of a second. But such an explosion would give us a force equal to only 20 tons of TNT, and you can get that from any ordinary blockbuster.
So what's the point? We can't spend $2 billion just for a blockbuster. We had those already.
That's right. But listen.
We knew, however, that for every 1/10,000,000th of a second more that you can hold those two hunks together, you increase the power of the bomb by 1,000. At Los Alamos, we learned a way to hold it together for that 1/10,000,000th of a second longer. And we put together a bomb that could do the work of 20,000 tons of TNT.
Then that timing business is the payoff.
Exactly, Bob. The longer you can hold the two pieces of uranium together, the more efficient a bomb you get. There can be no bigger bombs than those built at Los Alamos. All you can do to improve the bomb is to...
I know. Prolong that 1/1,000,000th of a second that you hold them together.
You astound me, Bob. Absolutely correct.
Of course, how they did that is a secret.
Perhaps the biggest secret of them all. But they did all three jobs at Los Alamos. And as Oppie said,
each component did exactly what it was expected to do. Failure of any one of these would have meant failure of the whole.
Finally, on July 16, 1945, Los Alamos had enough uranium to make a final test, and the first atom bomb was tested. We took up the New Mexico test last week, and you know, of course, that it worked. All that remained now was to slap these two pieces of uranium together over an enemy target. Meantime, uranium was rushed to the cruiser Indianapolis, which hoisted anchor and sailed for Tinian on the very same day as the Los Alamos explosion.
Early on Monday morning, July 16th at 05:30, reveille was sounded for all of us hands of the Indianapolis to get out of our sacks and make preparations for getting underway. But just before we left, a big wooden box was brought aboard. It was guarded from the time it came aboard until it was taken off. We knew it was something very important because we were going to make a high-speed run to Tinian in the Marianas.
Other bomb material, not yet ready, went in three heavy bombers whose pilots were unaware of their cargo. At Potsdam, Germany, couriers brought the news to Truman and Churchill, who told Stalin. On August 5th, the weather reports were favorable. Colonel Tibbetts was finally able to brief his boys.
Well, boys, tonight is the night we've all been waiting for. The bomb we're going to drop is different from any that you've ever heard about. It contains a destructive force equal to 20,000 tons of TNT. Three planes will fly the mission. The Enola Gay to carry the bomb. The primary target is Hiroshima.
That same day, an important change was made in the plan of operation. Some of the Los Alamos scientists and Captain Dick Parsons whose job it was to load the bomb and set the delicate mechanisms, watched several B-29s crash in takeoff. Parsons went to General Farrell and said,
"General, some of our scientists are quite worried about the possibility of a crash on takeoff with a bomb on board."
"So, Deke, if that happens, we lose the plane, the crew, the bomb, you and the whole darn island. You just pray that that doesn't happen."
"Well, it couldn't happen if I made the final assembly of the bomb in the bomb bay after we take off."
"Deke, have you ever done a final assembly like that before?"
"No, but I've got all day to practice."
"You mean when that plane left Tinian, the bomb wasn't all set?"
"No. And don't think we didn't think of that as we watched the Enola Gay take off and head for Hiroshima. As soon as the mission was airborne, we raced to the communications center where we could talk with Colonel Tibbets by radio and ask how Parsons was getting on with his assembly job. When we lost contact with the Enola Gay, he was still out in the bomb bay, his skilled fingers working on the delicate trigger mechanism."
I looked down at my hands. They were dirty, greasy hands, just as if I had fixed the carburetor and distributor in my car.
Bob Lewis, the plane's co-pilot, kept the log of the mission, a priceless document.
"It is 7:30. Parsons has put the final touches on his assembly job. We are now loaded. The bomb is alive. We start to climb to our final altitude at 7:40. Won't be long now. We have now set the automatic pilot for the last time until bombs away. Now it is 8:30. Dick Nelson, our radio operator, has just received a report from one of our weather planes. Hiroshima, our primary target, is clear. We are now ready for the final bomb run. It is 8:50. Not long now. There will be a short intermission now while we bomb our target."
Tom Ferriby, bombardier. "The Enola Gay had a 4-minute run over the perfectly open target. I manipulated the crosshairs of the bomb sight until the target was at the intersection of the course line and the rate line. The great bomb bay door swung open. I synchronized and let go."
The inert mass suspended in the interior came to life, freed itself, leaped out. Still, the two hunks of uranium were at opposite ends of the bomb. Down it hurtled. Eternal seconds passed. It was exactly 9:15, 00. Those inside the plane watched for a signal. Then it came, like a tiny light on a switchboard, a little pinpoint of purplish red light. Oppenheimer's trigger had slapped the two hunks of uranium together and held them so for that tenth of a millionth of a second.
The blue-white flash immediately grew into a giant ball of fire a half mile in diameter.
One of Fermi's neutrons had entered one atom. One atom had forced two neutrons into two more atoms, which gave forth four neutrons in a chain reaction. 2 billion trillion atoms smashed by 2 billion trillion neutrons in that split second.
The great fireball expanded into a huge mass of turning flames, exactly as it had in the darkness of the New Mexico desert. At the base of the lower part of the mushroom was a dust cloud several hundred feet thick, which covered most of Hiroshima. The mushroom top was a seething, turbulent cloud, which by now was almost at our height. When the blast arrived, we felt the shock wave. There were two short shocks, about 2 seconds apart. It felt like several flak bursts right under the wings.
The bomb did its damage in three ways. First, by blast.
"My name is Kleinsorger. I am a Jesuit priest. My mission was in Hiroshima 1,400 yards from the bomb center. It felt as though the bomb had fallen directly on us. It reminded me of something I had read as a boy, a large meteor colliding with the Earth.
The blast effect alone was equal to 20,000 tons of TNT. Then there was the fire effect.
I was 7 years old at the time, and more than 2,000 yards from the target center. I heard nothing, but when I looked up, I saw a sheet of fire, very, very bright and hot, like a great big sun.
For that split second, it was like a sun. 50 million degrees centigrade, three times hotter than the center of the sun. But there was a third kind of death from the bomb, radiation.
My sister and I were 2,000 yards away. My sister seemed quite normal during and after the blast. But week later, she became sick and suddenly died. Doctor said it was radiation.
We think of radiation as the rays you get from radium. There are less than 5 pounds of radium in all the world, where the radiation effect at Hiroshima was equal to several million tons of radium.
Bill, I'm staggered and bewildered by the whole thing. This was all caused by just a few pounds of uranium being banged together?
Yes, Bob. But here is another fantastic point. The Hiroshima bomb was only partially effective. Less than 1 gram of uranium, weighing less than one dime, actually was split and went into action. 78,000 people died at Hiroshima.
The President of the United States.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans.
You are listening to Chapter 2 of The Quick and the Dead, the NBC document for EAR on the atomic bomb and the possibilities of the new hydrogen bomb. Produced and transcribed by the NBC Newsroom.
And now, Mr. Hope, you know how the first atom bomb was dreamed and built.
Absolutely.
Any questions, Bob?
Only one. How do you make a hydrogen bomb?
That's our next lesson, Bob. We'll take that up next week.
Thanks, Bill. See you next week.
The Quick and the Dead is written and directed by Fred Friendly, supervision William F. Brooks, engineering William Schwartow. Most of the people in tonight's program played themselves, some were impersonated. Much of the material is taken from Mr. Lawrence's book, Dawn Over Zero. This is NBC.